Well, so I've been talking for 2 days now about a koan from the Blue Cliff Record, case 87, called by Master Yunmen, old favorite of mine. Master Yunmen was teaching his Sangha, and he said, medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself? So we've mostly been chewing on the first two parts of that, rather than the question it poses at the end, although, of what is yourself and how does that relate, although it's there when we talk about it. So the heart of this koan is this, the whole earth is medicine. It's the center. That throughout the earth, throughout life is medicine. Everything is medicine. Everything is something that can benefit or help or relieve suffering. That's the grand whole picture of things. We can take the first part, and there's very many ways and levels we've looked at this, but we take the first part, medicine and disease subdue each other, of course, talk about a relationship of mutuality, and then we're not just talking about some simple opposition, like enemies, who's going to win. Because they're always working together, against each other or together. So there's a deep mutuality, and each one brings up the other. This one is saying each one brings up the other. We think that a disease brings up medicine to respond to it. This is saying medicine is in some sense prior, the more original condition. But also says if they call each other up, then disease is everywhere too. On one hand, it's talking about this whole idea of opposition of helpful and unhelpful, good and bad, things we like, things we don't like, or things that are beneficial, things that are harmful. And another, talking about the human disease of ignorance, delusion of this cockamamie mind, which is everywhere we go, and our footprint is big. But the whole earth is medicine for this disease. He says yesterday that Katagiri Roshe, this reminds me a lot of Katagiri because he was the person I heard talk on this. And I have the record, I have a transcript of part of what he said that I hadn't read since I'd heard it. It's just been reverberating since then, and not wearing his okesa, and it all kind of, there we are. It's all borrowed. This is his okesa and Tozin's stick that he got from someone before him, that high abbot of Sojiji Temple, who's two generations back in our line. Anyway, Katagiri said about this medicine that we awaken to our ignorance, not from it. And as I said yesterday, I didn't like that very much. I wanted to wake up out of my ignorance. Painful, I want to wake up from it. Goodbye, thank you. Surely, peace and harmony is waking up from my ignorance into a world of peace and harmony. And so he said that the medicine for our human delusion, our human deluded mind, is to wake up to our ignorance. And that is the way we come out of its spell, much more effectively than if we try to awaken from it and turn away from it. It'll bite us in the rear if we turn away from it. And you can't subdue it once and for all. As long as you have a mind, it's going to keep producing thoughts, and you're going to turn those thoughts into deluded ideas of this is how it really is, not just this is my subjective experience of it, for instance. So as long as you have a mind, which I hope you have the rest of your life, you will keep creating this disease of the mind. The disease of the mind will be happening. You won't create the disease. Well, comes with the mind. It comes as a sort of an inevitable consequence of having this kind of mind. Maybe there's another world system where minds are constructed differently, where they aren't this binary. We discern light from dark, this from that, here from there, me from other. I mean, babies have to learn, work hard to learn. I'm here and I am finite and you're there, and then there's a space between, so maybe we can work with that. And the baby's got to learn that. It's not going to get along in the world. It's not going to operationally get along. It's not going to be able to learn. It's not going to be able to thrive as a human being if it doesn't start to learn all this discrimination. And it's how the mind develops. Without that knowledge, the baby can't thrive, can't move into life, and the mind can't develop. So we got to do that. That's bad. But then we say, oh, that's how it is, not this is what the mind is doing. Not this is the way the mind is perceiving. And that mind then creates ignorance and war when it's in the spell of ignorance. But this is the same mind that creates poetry and koans and love. We don't get to pick and choose between having a mind that's medicine and having a mind that's disease. We have a mind that does both. The question is how. So this is, what is yourself? How are you going to be a person that has a mind that's medicine and a mind that's disease, and that keeps subduing each other and encouraging each other? How are you going to meet this? What even would it mean to say that? How do you locate yourself in the whole earth is medicine? Or in medicine and disease subdue each other. They're talking about you and me. One of the things I like in medicine and disease subdue each other is this sense of endless activity. Endless event. That's what we are. We think we're a thing. And write it off. We're caught. We're stuck. We're under the spell of our delusions. We think we're a thing. But I'm a higher order thing than you are. You're an object, and I'm a living thing. You're just an object in my environment. So there's different kinds of things in my world. But even the whole I'm a thing is already, I'm going to treat myself. We each treat ourselves kind of like an object to be basted and roasted and, you know, tidied up and shaped up and marched along. And then we do that even worse to each other, to other people. Well, I don't know, worse. Sometimes we do it worse to ourselves, but we do. You think we do it worse to ourselves? Okay. I think I grant you that. But one of the things that reasons we get so caught in the spell of taking ourselves as things is that it gives us a sense of security. Oh, I'm a here. There's a this. There's a me. Because if the self is an event, it feels very unstable. And but that again is, I think, that's because we have this idea that events are going to yank things out from under us. And actually, it's because I'm a wobbly thing that when the rug is pulled, I fall over. Events don't fall over. It's things that don't have roots that fall over. So what kind of an event is the self in which it has this disease of the mind, and it has this, what is the medicine for this disease of the mind that we have? So that means we have to ask, what kind of an event are we? You know, I was talking with Dave this morning, and we were talking about the self as a pile of parts. And this is an early stage of Buddhism. He said, you're just a pile of parts. Get over it. There isn't a self thing in the middle of that. Yes, but the fact is that also we are a very beautiful pattern, beautiful and awful pattern of parts. The pattern that we call ourselves. We're willing to have, We can continue to understand ourselves to be ourselves, but some small piece gets lopped off. You lose your youth, you lose your big toe, you lose your ear, you lose your eyesight, you're still you. The bigger the piece, the harder it is to feel you're still you, but we can lose a number of parts, inner and outer parts, and pieces of our life and pieces of our environment, the life, and still recognize ourselves as ourselves. Because there's a pattern. What we really are is a pattern. And that pattern isn't lost if we lose a few parts. We lose a lot of them, we lose the coherence of the pattern and our life gets completely confused. We're a very intricate tapestry, finely woven out of creativity and thoughtfulness and discerning and love and ignorance and delusion and war and craving and clinging and greed and hatred and eyes and ears and noses, all these things woven together. So the Colin is saying, can you understand yourself as a self to be both the whole earth is medicine, and medicine and disease subdue each other and are constantly actively working in all these different things and ways. This is medicine and that's disease. Can you understand yourself to be those two? And what does that mean for you? So it's, what does that mean for your life? Medicine and disease cover the earth or subdue each other or pacify each other or cure each other, all these different translations that are concerned about the nature of this activity. But that's not the only thing. It's that there's medicine and disease everywhere relating in all these different ways, bringing each other forth and curing and killing each other. And all this is going on all the time. That's the world of many phenomena. Right? And they're endless phenomena. And they're forever bringing each other forth and knocking each other down. And there's this and there's that. This is medicine and that's disease. This is subduing and that's pacifying. It's the world of many phenomena, many differences, all the different aspects of life, all the different beings, all the different events and things. That is the world from the perspective of there being many myriad beings, many differences, many different things and phenomena. And it's true. And it's relevant. It's just not the whole picture. Living as though that's the whole picture inevitably is a world of limitation and conflict, because there's only differences and then there's only a world of difference and opposition, and maybe you can have negotiations between the differences, but this basically is a world of differences. If that's all you have. But it is not that there's a wrong perspective to think that there are many beings and many events. This is a world of myriad differences. And the whole earth is medicine is the perspective of one whole universe. There isn't, in the story I related yesterday about Sudhana, Manjushri sends Sudhana out to find something, see if he can find something that is not medicine. And he searches and searches and says he can't find anything that's not medicine. And so Manjushri says, so go back and find something that is medicine for me. And he picks up a blade of grass. Everything is medicine. The whole earth. And not just each thing, but the earth itself. The nature of earthness, the nature of each of the beings that is each blade of grass is medicine. And that's a universal perspective. We are both. The self and us are both. I might say that's the perspective in a way of emptiness. And we always think of emptiness sounds empty. And it isn't. It's empty of being bound by all, it's empty of all the, of living, it's not all the differences. It's not all the boundaries and all the separations. It's the world where things are not separate and not different, empty of being opposed to each other, to one world. So we are both of these sides simultaneously. We are individuals who act from the perspective of myriad many beings. When we act, it's always particular. This particular body moves through space, utters particular words that do or do not make sense to your ears, relates to a particular person or a few particular people, walks on a particular floor. That's living in the from the perspective of myriad beings. We have to, and if we understand that we are, in some sense, that we are also one whole earth, we are, if each blade of grass is medicine, then we are all medicine, and we share this medicinal nature. We share this nature of something good coming from the earth. And what we share then allows me to come closer to you, to see, oh, well, not just me here and you there, but there's something shared and exchanged. And so then I can relate in both ways, through our differences and through our sameness, which all the whole earth is medicine. The perspective of our sameness or the whole earth is medicine is what we call Buddha nature. That goodness comes forth naturally everywhere. We're not just one person or one blade of grass among many that are completely separate from each other. No. We're made of the fact that some protein 4 billion years ago managed to replicate itself. And we're all made of that. You know, there's so many ways in which, you know, as different individual beings, we're made of each other and each other, and we're made of each other's lives. So it wouldn't happen with us without us being here, sitting here together. I once had a session alone. Once. But that was because there was a context of Sangha that needed that to happen. It was Valley Zendo in Massachusetts many years ago, just after Koshi Ichida, who gave me the name Jisho, after he went back to Japan. He'd been there for 10 years. And then his wife's illness took him back to Japan, although he'd expected to stay. And so there was no one leading practice there. And it was a very small sangha. It was a very, very, very small sangha. Sessions often had 3, 4, 5 people, or 2, 3, 4, or 5 people. And people came and went a little bit during it. And so the very informal sangha decided to try to keep sessions going, because that was the main engine there of practice. It was the daily practice for anyone who lived there, and at that point it had only been Koshi. And every month there was session, 5 days. And so we would, 2 or 3 people together, and finally one month, because I think it was May, that year after he left, and there was no one else could do the session, and so I did it. And a couple of other people came just for a few hours, just to lend me support, and it was very nice. But I wasn't doing it alone, I was still doing it in relation to Koshi, whom I then stayed and began actually closer to. I visited him whenever I went to Japan. I'm still corresponding. He died. I'm still corresponding with his wife. I was doing it to help hold the being of a sangha together. Eventually, someone else came from the Uchiyama line, because he was one of Uchiyama Roshi's disciples, and took over. But we kept it alive. So sitting alone wasn't sitting alone. It was really sitting with myriad beings. But still, there seems, from our human perspective, to be these two aspects. The world of myriad beings coming and going, contentious and creative, and somehow a world we call the Buddha world, or Buddha nature, or oneness, or unity, merging of difference and unity, what we call the harmony of difference and sameness, is talking about that. Different, all the world of different myriad beings, sameness, that there is something that is the same, that's provisionally called by a name like Buddha nature, or life energy, or impermanence. All of these are words in some way for what we not only have in common, but exist as who and what we are. So we have these two sides, and we're somehow also a crossroads of these two, because in our minds they're two separate kinds of things. There's lots of beings, and there's some kind of sense of unity or oneness that we kind of prefer usually. But we are always both. They're not two separate worlds except from the perspective of this mind. The world one is also called absolute reality in a lot of texts. But I never liked this language that says one is absolute reality and one is relative reality, because it sounds less real. And they really mean it to sound less real, but what it really means is everything is existing in relation to everything else. That sense of relative. Not just relatively messy or, you know, relatively unreal. You know, that's because that's how it comes to sound. And it comes to sound that way because that is also how we think. That's why we want to wake up from our ignorance. We want to wake up from this sense world of being contentious things into something that's different. But as, just as our wonderful poem, The Harmony, Difference, and Sameness is saying, what is, actually there's, there are two worlds, a world of many and a world of one. But we can't say there's just a world of one and not of many. There is one world in which each blade of grass and each person is expressing the whole of what life is. Because this is kind of abstract, both Katagiri and Uchiyama Roshi liked to talk in terms of our small self and our big self, a more personal way of relating to this kind of issue. So our small self is, I remember when I first became his student, Katagiri's student, I'd met him in Massachusetts while I was searching for a teacher and said, ah, there he is. And he went back to Minnesota. So the next year I went out to Minnesota to say, what's a sangha? What are these people like? Are they all going to be wandering around with it 2 inches, you know, floating 2 inches above the floor? But, you know, they were all Minnesotans. So it was all right. But I was going to leave. And I asked, you know, leave again for a year. So I spent a couple of weeks there and I talked with him and I asked him if he would be my teacher, if he would accept me as his student. And he said yes. And then I went back and he sent me a card. He sent me a note in which he said, I still have it, drag it out. He said something like, we can't just be the small self, we have to swim in the big ocean. I didn't know what he was talking about. Saying we are always a person who is an individual person. That's not wrong. So small can get to sound faulty, but we are small. Well, we're an individual person who has an individual perspective and needs and wishes. And that immediately turns into, and I want this and I don't want that, and I get greedy and needy and clingy and craving and hatred. And all this stuff starts to come up out of the same premise from which I think I am this small self, rather than this is, I'm just an individual with a personal perspective. If we only live in terms of our personal perspective, then our world is very small. Because my world ends with my skin, and that's a pretty small world. So I think what they're calling small self is the self we each have that thinks only in terms of our differences and of me versus you, at the pile of parts, and I want more of them. And this big self that was swimming in a big ocean instead of a little pond, I think he actually said. Is our self realizing that we are connected to the whole universe and acting on that basis. We can only do that as an individual. And so there are two separate worlds. But the aspect of ourselves, who we are when we realize that we are connected to the whole universe, that we're made of everything else. You know, the self is made of non-self elements. When we realize that we really are made of each other, that our lives are so deeply intermingled, that our lives are made of each other's lives. The big self realizes that it's made of the whole universe and acts on that basis. That realization that we are the universe expressing itself. Not just my ideas. We are the universe expressing itself. And we have some choices about the way in which we do that. That's wisdom. And that self that understands it is the whole universe expressing itself in this individual form and acting on us, that's compassion or magnanimity. So Uchiyama Roshi also calls it magnanimous mind. And that's in his the book that we'll use in our April study group. We're going to go back. Tasha, you were there for that original study group. Probably the only one here who was. When we was on the very first, probably the very first study group ever here at Regal Road was studying this. It's now published again as How to Cook Your Life. Refining Your Life, it was called then. He talks about magnanimous mind. And how that, what that is in a human perspective, rather than some 16-foot golden perspective of Buddha that we don't think we are. Maybe it's almost as a little bit of an aside, but we get very confused because we think that this what gets called a small self that thinks only in terms of concrete particulars, and in terms, therefore it winds up thinking of mine versus yours, and I want more of them because there's a limited pie and all of that. Because that self just suffers. You know, that self suffers greatly. It needs kindness, not just a kick in the pants. It needs kindness. It needs some firmness too. But we think that because this suffering being that's so caught in the torments of what is mine and what I don't have and what I want and need and cling and crave, it's tormented. That the problem is all that this world of differences and many phenomena. We should rush to the world of Buddha's world of oneness. The world of many phenomena is not the problem. The world of many phenomena is the world that expresses Buddha nature, or Buddha, or wisdom, or compassion. It doesn't come up anywhere else. So anything that's thought of as the whole universe, whole earth is medicine, or that there is something good coming up out of in life, or some kind of basic goodness, it can only possibly express itself in each of the particular beings. There isn't some other world called heaven, not in this whole scheme of things. The magnanimous mind, the big self, is really ourselves able to understand whole both, that I can only act as an individual particular being, and this individual particular being is always going to slide into the kind of small self where I only think in those terms. But that's not all I am. I'm also, as an individual, the universe expressing itself, Buddha nature expressing itself, the nature of awakening and compassion is us. So our magnanimous mind, our magnanimous self sees each being and thing as both. It's when I understand that you and I both are this individual who slides into thinking me first and you way down the pike, and knowing that that's only one view and that really I'm an individual and you're an individual, both expressing life itself with a tremendous shared nature, then we can meet in a very interesting way. And when we meet in that interesting way, there's more meeting going on and my life gets bigger. It enhances my own life. It's not some kind, there isn't a separate thing called altruism. I remember as kids, we would debate this. You know, is it altruistic? Because if that makes you feel good, then it was selfish. And those are important questions to worry about. But in fact, it's another one of those false paradoxes. There's no such separate thing as altruism. What is, if you do something that is good on the earth, it's goodness. And it's your world that is, receives whatever it gives of goodness. They're not two separate things, giving and receiving. But we need the perspective also of each individual being, and individual beings have individual suffering and individual deaths and individual problems. So that the side that we call, or the larger whole that we call magnanimous mind has to take those into account. You can't ignore them and say, oh, now we will have peace and harmony. Get out of the way here. It's being magnanimous toward the problems of individuals. So disease is there. Medicine is there. The medicine of a large and magnanimous understanding of our shared nature and of our all-expressing life. Is happening in a world where there is endless disease and problem, dis-ease at the very least, and problems. And it has to act in relation to those with wisdom and kindness. It's not an escape from the world. It's an entry into the world. So to say that everything is good or is good for you is too simplistic. Not everything is good for us. No question. Everything is as it is. We have to accept that, but we don't accept that everything is good for us. That's just sort of a simplistic. That's not what Buddha nature means. Just seeing a positive side of things is not the meaning of seeing absolute reality or seeing one or seeing Buddha nature, understanding, or waking up. Seeing the whole means requires seeing disease as it is, never apart from you. The this case in the Blue Cliff Record in itself is just this short piece. Medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole earth is medicine. What is yourself? That just leaves you with the question. There isn't another dialogue, there isn't a monk who proposes an answer, and the master who answers it. But there is, these, the koan collections, the cases are themselves a whole little put together thing. There's the case that was selected by a later master, cases of anecdotes and stories that involve one of each of a different, many different teachers. And in this case, Yuan Wu collected these later, well, no. Shui Do, one master collected them and wrote verses. He said, this 100 anecdotes, stories are really useful, really good. I'm going to collect those. And he wrote a verse about each one. And that's the core of the Blue Cliff Record. But then another master, one who wrote commentaries on them, and then it really became the Blue Cliff Record. So it has all these different layers. And one of the layers is that there's a little prologue or an introduction to each of the cases called a pointer. And the pointer in this one is all about the self. It's really about the question that the case poses. What is the self? But we know a lot about the self that is deluded. And we also know in our practice something about seeing that self. And we begin to learn in our practice something about not identifying with ourselves, our more deluded ideas. We have these ideas, but we don't have to identify with them, and that's a lot of what happens in Zazen. But so what is the clear-eyed person who sees both sides, sees the side of the small self who's caught in believing that many different things, the many differentnesses is all there is, and I better get mine. And this magnanimous big self, sometimes called, who sees in terms of the unity of all things or the Buddha nature of all things. So the pointer is talking about what the writer calls the clear-eyed person. Say the person whose eyes are open. Now, you and I are in the process of waking up, going to sleep, waking up and going to sleep. The clear-eyed person's eyes are open. So this is the direction we're going. And sometimes we are already the clear-eyed person, and then we fall asleep and forget about that. But we are each also the clear-eyed person. So here's what it says. The clear-eyed person has no nest. Sometimes she stands on top of the mountain with weeds growing in profusion. Sometimes she is in the bustle of the marketplace, freely at ease. Suddenly she's an angry titan with three heads and six arms. Suddenly she's the sun-faced or moon-faced Buddha releasing the light of all-embracing compassion. In every atom she manifests all phenomena. Mixing with people, she trudges through mud and water. Of course, I must admit, in the translation I'm quoting, it says he, but it's a mistake. It's a typo. What does it mean to be a clear-eyed person? It means to have no nest. It means not to engage, to keep abandoning that nest-building instinct. Not that you don't have a home or a place that is familiar, you know how to return to, but not building the nest where you hide away and seeing always that tendency to do that. That's the tendency we have to you cushion ourselves in sashin. I want a little something more here. I'm going to bring a chocolate bar. I used to always bring a chocolate bar. There's nothing wrong with that, but I had to know. I didn't this time. I didn't have time to buy one. I probably would have brought one. But it's the knowing still that it's that urge to have a little cushion the impact of life. Right? So it's pretty innocent when it's a chocolate bar. But we need to know it also operates in a very big scale. This wanting to cushion ourselves from life. The clear-eyed person knows there's no place to hide or be hidden away from life. Not really. And so doesn't pretend that or try to do that, or keeps unbuilding the nest. Well, one hand building the nest and the other hand taking that nest apart and offering it to birds who need it more. When we aren't building nests and shutting ourselves off from the world and trying to create a little cozy corner, like the rat that built a cozy corner in the corner from a little insulation, a little shell from a little nut that it probably had for lunch, it's a nice cozy little nest. But when we do that, it's one thing to have a mattress and a home and a little, you know, house. It's when we do that with our life, building a little cozy apartness, cushioning us from life, there's something mistaken in that. The clear-eyed person who's engaged in unbuilding the nest, that we're also engaged in building, is open to what's there, is present, and able to accord with things as they are because we're not already going like this. So this clear-eyed person sometimes stands on top of the mountain, or as Katagiri said, in solitary splendor on top of the solitary peak. Sometimes we are just present ourselves as ourselves alone without being engaged in being in relation to anything. Top of a solitary peak. Sometimes you're sitting alone at the ocean watching the waves or walking in the woods or sitting zazen. And this is the clear-eyed person now, not just we're not hiding here. It's just being present. And when we're standing on top of the mountain, the weeds are growing in profusion. And it was interesting, Katagiri's take on weeds growing in profusion was he said, that's all the beings who need you and it's compassion. Not the weeds you're supposed to pull up and put in the compost heap. Oh, weeds there, let's pull the weeds so we can go on in our solitary splendor. No. In the middle of our solitary splendor, of our time of feeling at peace, alone, just I'm here, now, me, the weeds are growing in profusion, and that's how it ought to be. She stands on top of the mountain with weeds growing in profusion. All the medicine and disease subduing each other is all growing in around. All those blades of grass are busy growing while I'm standing in solitary splendor or sitting at the edge of the ocean. Life in all its many forms is happening all around me. We're not hindering each other. I'm not even apart from it. The weeds are growing in profusion right at my feet while I'm sitting there. So what he says is the weeds growing in profusion. I like that. We're the sort of the many faces and needs of all the beings that are growing up in profusion. And what am I doing when I'm sitting here or being at some time in my life in peace with myself, at peace with myself? There's a time of being just there alone at peace with myself, and then the next moment the weeds call out to me and I have to respond to the weeds. But I'm going to be able to respond to the weeds, these weeds or those weeds or whatever the weeds are, because at that point I'm present and nourished by being present. So this what feels like, oh, I want some peace and quiet in my life. I want to be myself alone. I want to be alone. We all have this one too. This kind of aloneness is aloneness that is also Avalokiteshvara going like this, always ready to respond. It's not apart from. It's a peace that's always not going to be lost by moving out. Sometimes there's the clear-eyed person is quietly alone. Sometimes the clear-eyed person is engaged. So when standing on top of the mountain, the weeds grow in profusion. Then, sometimes, not standing on top of the mountain, she's in the bustle of the marketplace. Sometimes she's in the bustle of the marketplace, freely at ease. Now, usually when I'm in the bustle of the marketplace, I want to run screaming for cover because there's all this stuff going on. But there are ways, as kinds of being in the marketplace, in a way, this is. Here we are. We think of the shin as a part. What are we doing? There's a group of us here interacting and cooking and cleaning and eating and sitting. And this in itself, too, is being in our kind of a quiet version of being in the bustle in the midst of the marketplace. At the same time that we're also just sitting quietly on our own. It's almost like tryouts for being able to be freely at ease in a more bustling marketplace. When we're really settled with ourselves, it's okay if there's a bunch of people around doing all kinds of different things. It doesn't interfere with us. When we're not all right with ourselves, we're not settled with ourselves, we're not clear-eyed, we're just so reactive and knocked around by all that busyness happening that we call the world. The clear-eyed person, the person who's individual, living as an individual, and with this large view of the magnanimous mind. Sometimes, suddenly, she's an angry titan. Titans are angry, fierce beings. With three heads and six arms. There's a fierce wisdom looking in all sorts of directions and with lots of arms to reach out and do something. This is a fierce compassion where you have to save someone. This is the... where you have to save someone in the midst of terrible circumstances, perhaps. Or where you have to see clearly in difficult circumstances. It isn't always smooth. Sometimes it's an angry, fierce expression of life and compassion, and suddenly, the sun face or moon face Buddha, some of the very famous koan, the sun face Buddha lives for thousands and thousands of years, and the moon face Buddha lives for one night. Now, it's said to be what, I think it's Joshu, I think, said on his deathbed, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Well, and people start debating it immediately. Does that mean, it's better to be a sun-faced Buddha than a moon-faced Buddha because he lives longer? Suddenly a sun-faced or moon-faced Buddha, whatever the particular form the clear-eyed person takes. Suddenly a sun or face or moon face Buddha, she releases the light of all embracing compassion. whatever form you're in, when you're clear-eyed, you're able to release compassion because you aren't engaged in contracting. In every atom, she manifests all phenomena. When we know that, I mean, that's a kind of an abstract statement, but that's that each part of us is expressing of the whole. Each one of us is Buddha nature. It's not like I have a little corner of Buddha nature, or I have a little particle of it, and you have another little particle of it. We are all expressing the one same Buddha nature. And mixing with people, she trudges through mud and water. That's our life. We mix with people and we trudge through mud and water. There's nothing wrong with that. It's nice to be a Busan. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you do. I don't know, once I trudged through mud and water up to my waist with no boots on. I was on a canoeing trip. A big, long, the trail just led right through that swamp. There was nowhere else to go but down into it. And I had to go first, I decided, because I had injured myself and I couldn't carry canoes. I couldn't portage a canoe. But I could, at that point, I could still carry a Duluth pack with a pump strap on my back. But since I couldn't carry a canoe, I thought, least I can do is sacrifice myself into the muck. The leeches, the, you know, not my favorite thing. So I thought, the least I can do is go first, since I don't have a canoe on and since I can't do that. It was actually quite pleasant, because he went on and on through until it was too long to start, keep thinking, ooh, ooh, ooh. You know, you get tired of thinking, ooh, ooh, ooh. You're still surviving, so you just go on walking through the mud and water. It was really kind of nice. It was pleasant in the end. And I don't think I had any leeches on me. We checked, but I mean, there were leeches around. They weren't a major phenomenon except in my mind, as it turned out. So mixing with people, we're going to trudge through mud and water. Oh, being a person, we're going to trudge through mud and water. So we may as well do it mixing with people. So some of this we know we can do. Some of this we know we are, and some of it we don't know about ourselves. And yet it's who we are. This is what the self is, all of that. Not just no self, all of that. You know, the clear-eyed person is generally not stopping and thinking, oh, I'm clear-eyed. When we're both clear-eyed is when we're our eyes are open and we're looking out. And then we say, oh, I'm clear-eyed, or it doesn't. Oh, look, I'm actually here. And what am I doing then? Running a narrative, an analytic discourse, bean counting again. So I have to let that go. That's why Dogen says you really don't know it when your realization is none of your business. It is your business, but you don't know it. Knowing it isn't your business. That's why we talk about aiming, not only because, oh, we can only go a little ways, we can't really get there, we can't be clear-eyed. Aiming is because that you only become clear-eyed when you focus on aiming, not on getting there. Because the getting there is part of the bean counting approach, part of the analysis and counting and separating. There's a there to get to as opposed to here. Dropping the there, there's a there to get to opposed to here, aiming at waking up, aiming at being awake, aiming at being clear-eyed, aiming at being present together. That's when we can actually be clear-eyed. So we can only achieve any end in this sense when we forget about it. But not completely, so we don't have any orientation, so we don't just go build a nest. So we keep aiming to wake up. Isn't it an interesting koan that medicine and disease subdue each other? The whole earth is medicine. What is the self? Roger.
Okay, Gary's note to you.
Yeah.
Was he telling you, don't get too excited about this, or don't...
No. He was saying, do get excited about this, really. He was saying, this is big. Don't think of yourself as just a... what he wanted me to vow as a student. I knew it wasn't specifically that I'm smaller than somebody else. It wasn't about that. Or that I'm thinking some particular way. He's saying, here's what it means. He said, is the duty of a student of mine, is I think how he put it, to not just be, live as a small self, but to swim in a big ocean. So, you know, I didn't understand, but he was saying, this is what I want it to mean to you to be practicing seriously as my student, is not to just get caught in thinking only in terms of a small personal self and I'm his student and I'm not someone else's student. All the, you know, I'm a real Zen student, I'm not a real Zen student. All these things we can get caught up in. He wanted me to try to understand a largeness of life. He was not saying you do or you don't or you're this far. He was not doing comparisons. He was just saying this is what it means to know that there's something beyond a small understanding of yourself. I'll find that. The note sometimes is, you know, approximately where it is. But of course, I couldn't make any sense out of it at all for quite a long time. But that was all right, too. Because I knew he was trying to encourage me, and I could be encouraged even if I didn't know what he meant. And then... No, I went out the next year and he was glad to see me. And then I moved out there so I could train under him and be ordained. And then when he was dying and he was in last brief remission, he came to my house for tea. There was this hope that maybe he could get out and not just be this sick guy, you know, who's dying, and maybe he isn't dying, you know. So anyway, he came, he had been not going out, she came to my house for tea, and with Tejo, three of us were there, and Tejo, in the conversation, turned around and around, and Tejo asked him if he remembered. I told him my story, what I remembered of my first Dokusan event in Massachusetts, when I went in Dokusan and I sat down and I said, what's the nature of the teacher-student relationship? Because that's what I was concerned about. I'd been sitting with all kinds of, and I found every interesting teacher I could find in Zen on the East Coast. I had gone and sat with or encountered in some way, and so far I hadn't found, I sat with all of them, I hadn't found one that looked, maybe this could work, until I met him. So I said, what is the teacher-student relationship? And he said, the teacher carries the student on his back. God knows what he means by that. So I said, does that mean I don't have to understand what it is? And he said, that's right. He had to carry, he was supposed to then, the teacher would carry the understanding of what the teacher-student relationship is too. And so then many years later, 10 years later roughly, Tejo was saying, well, do you remember? I told him. He said, I know I don't remember that. He said, but I remember the first time I saw you. He didn't remember the Dokusan, but he remembered our meeting there on a break, and I was sitting on the ground. I was delirious with joy. I finally found a teacher I liked, and I was sitting with Sushin, and it was sunny. You know, all these good things were happening all at the same time. And I probably had a grin that went from there to there and ear to ear, and he walked by and our eyes locked and we just grinned at each other, and that's what he remembered. He remembered me from that. And then the next year I showed up in Minnesota. So there's these meetings, these things. And so then he said, you have to swim in a big ocean. In a very little place in Fall Forest though, we can swim in a big ocean. Anyway, enough stories.